Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer reading to you from the Decatur Herald and Review. It's January 18th, 2021, and we will begin on the front page with the article headlined, Decatur Government, Minefield Awaits Vote on Restrictions. Tony Reed writes, Decatur City Council members who pledged to take a vote on whether to relax restrictions on indoor service at bars and restaurants when they meet Tuesday are going to be faced with tap dancing their way through a regulatory and financial minefield. The risk, city officials warn, is that the state will retaliate expensively against cities that defy the rules put in place to try and slow the COVID-19 pandemic. But council members Chuck Kuhl and Lisa Gregory made it clear at the last council meeting on January 11th that they wanted a vote on allowing at least a reopening to 25% of individual restaurants and bars' indoor customer capacity. It was agreed a vote would be taken at Tuesday's meeting. The Macon County Board has already leapt ahead on that front, voting January 14th to allow indoor dining at 25% capacity for county businesses falling under its ordinances. City members had been hoping Governor J.B. Pritzker would have made the situation a whole lot easier by choosing to lift indoor dining restrictions in the area covering the city, but he balked at going that far after reviewing virus infection rates on Friday. That bounced the COVID buck back to the city, already under intense pressure from business owners to do something to save their bottom lines. And so now the virus legal minefield stretches out before the council. In a briefing document prepared for council members, City Manager Scott Wrighton prefers what might be described as softly approach. On the one hand, he suggests the option of just telling city staff to relax their enforcement and inspection strategies while leaving the ordinances outlawing indoor dining in place. Or, among other possibilities, he suggests maybe going for an ordinance change that permits limited indoor dining under certain stringent safety requirements, while avoiding any mention of the state-mandated rules it will be superseding. The options Wrighton lists as the most legally dangerous are passing any kind of ordinance rewrite that reads as a clear rejection of the state's no indoor service mandate. Taking affirmative action to formally and officially contravene the governor's orders brings the city unreasonable risks and is not recommended, Wrighton tells council members. It places current and future funding that Decatur has received from the state of Illinois in jeopardy. It could also expose the city to future litigation. Speaking Sunday in advance of the meeting, Deputy City Manager John Kinseth said the city has handed out hundreds of thousands of dollars in money sanctioned by the state to help businesses crippled by the effects of COVID-19. In a lot of these cases, the city has advanced the agreed sums, which the state has agreed to reimburse. But if Decatur is seen as frustrating the governor's orders, fine print in financial agreements calling for the city to follow state rules could be used as a weapon to hit back. Ultimately, the state says, we are not going to reimburse you for that money because you are openly defying the governor's orders, said Kinseth. Certainly, the state has indicated that it is a tool they have should they need to use it. There are plenty of other potential legal landmines, too. Wrighton worries about personal injury lawyers gliding in to look for cases that will work as civil lawsuits in situations where someone gets sick after eating in a Decatur restaurant or drinking in a Decatur bar. It is reasonable to presume that after the worst of the pandemic has passed, personal injury lawyers will scout for potential defendants with financial resources that they believe have acted capriciously or with alleged misconduct regarding COVID and its effects, he added. Both Wrighton and Kinseth note that Illinois is one of the states where lawmakers have failed to pass liability protection from such potential lawsuits. Kinseth also pointed out that if the council does go ahead and sanction some form of indoor dining, the businesses involved will also face their own minefields. He said state liquor and other business licenses will still be at risk, and there will be nothing the city can do to protect businesses from state regulatory and legal action. The state still has the ability to come in and yank those licenses, Kinseth added. And also on the front page, Menar looks back on Senate tenure. Democrat to take role in Pritzker administration. Senator Andy Menar, Democrat from Bunker Hill, has been in public office since he could barely buy a beer at a local bar. For the past 23 years, he has been an elected official in his hometown in Macoupin County and in the state legislature. Ask anyone who works with him, and they speak glowingly about his ability to connect with people, both as a politician and a senator. There are very few elected officials and public servants that are as good as Andy Menar, said Bill Houlihan, a member of the Democratic State Central Committee in the 18th Congressional District and the state director for U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He does the little things. It's the little things that impress people in what you do, and Andy Menar does that all the time. Those little things have pushed Menar into a key role in the Senate Democratic Caucus, one that he leaves behind January 17th. Menar announced his resignation on Monday after three terms in the 48th Senate District in order to take an advisory position with Governor J.B. Pritzker. His role in Pritzker's office will be to help him with boosting the economic impact of his policies downstate, while also assisting in the response with the state's budget problems. He leaves behind a broad legacy, one that has touched the lives of millions of people throughout the state, including those who have never met him. His most important role was that of reforming the state's long-troubled school financing laws. His bill, signed into law in 2017, was one that he takes credit for, but one that he knows he didn't do alone. It's because thousands of people stood up and demanded change, Menar said. Through the ups and downs and setbacks and the advances, that only got over the finish line because of regular folks, parents, teachers, principals, administrators, community leaders raising their voices and telling the General Assembly and Governor Bruce Rauner that they wanted the world to change. Menar said the school funding system in Illinois was the least equitable system in the U.S. Through his funding legislation, he was able to give schools in poorer areas first priority for state money. When looking back on his legislation, Menar said that it was the kind of change in state school funding that only comes along once in a while. It was a generational change, there is no doubt about it, Menar said. It's humbling to know that my name is associated with that, but I want to be crystal clear. That didn't happen because of me. Even though the school funding bill has had a massive impact on how schools receive state dollars, he remembers a vote from early in his tenure as being the most important one he made. In February 2013, just 1 month after he was first sworn in as a state senator, Menar had to vote on Senate Bill 10, which legalized same-sex marriage in Illinois. his district isn't quite one that people would assume would be supportive of such legislation. Both Donald Trump and Bruce Rauner won the district in 2016 and 2018, respectively. But Menard voted yes on the bill, and he understands how important it was to hundreds of thousands across the state who finally had the opportunity to exercise their right to get married in Illinois. It was, without question, a difficult vote to make, Menard said. As every day has passed since then, I am even more confident that it was the right thing to do. Menard has been an advocate for same-sex marriage and LGBTQ rights in Illinois, something that he noted wasn't quite the thing that one would expect from somebody who comes from traditionally Republican downstate Illinois. That's not typical of a downstate legislator, Menard said. Supporting marriage equality early in my first term is a legislative issue that stands out to me, even though I was not a sponsor of the bill. His fellow Senate Democrats are sad to see one of the most effective legislators leave, even though he isn't leaving the Democratic team. John Patterson, spokesperson for Senate President Don Harmon, said that Menard's move to the governor's office was a tough loss for the Senate caucus. "We will labor on," Patterson said. "I think it's good for the state of Illinois, but we will obviously miss Senator Menard. He has accomplished a lifetime of accomplishments in his short and young career." Even Republicans have their share of praise for what Menard was as a legislator and a politician. Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican from Bloomington, said that he was the kind of person that you could work with and have a good relationship, even if he was a member of the opposite party. "In the minority, we would look to those in the majority and look for information and common ground," Berrickman said. "Andy was one of those whom I could speak to and seek it. He was a worthy adversary on the big issues where there might be ideological differences, but he was always someone you could work with and try to understand where you might find common ground." Since 1997, Menard has had to stand before the people of his town, county, and district to be elected. With this new role, he only faces one man, Pritzker. Menard seems comfortable taking on this new challenge and isn't thinking about getting back into political office anytime soon. "I am exiting public office for the first time since I was 22 years old," Menard said. "The prospect of something like that, higher office, is far in the distance. I'm proud of my career in public service. The people of the 48th District elected me 3 times, and I did the best that I could do each and every day. Now I'm transitioning into something different, still involved in state government in a meaningful way, but not elected. This is a very different thing for me, and I'm looking forward to this new role that's coming up on the 18th. And next, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. MLK still resonates in divided U.S. Few people are as synonymous with a moment in time as Martin Luther King Jr. is with the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s in America. King sought equality and human rights for African Americans, the economically disadvantaged, and all victims of injustice through peaceful protest. During this time of partisan rancor and divisiveness, does his message still resonate today? Harvey Edwards, a professor at Susquehanna University and a former teacher in the Sellings Grove School District, said he believes it does, albeit in a narrow way. "I say that because I think most young people believe, but when they hear Dr. King, they think only of nonviolence as his forte for protesting," he said. Martin strongly believed in protests by standing up to injustices, not just for black people, but for anyone who was oppressed. when what he advocated is narrowed down to believing he was just about nonviolence and equal rights for black people, that is where many young people might not have a sense of the gravity of what he was trying to do, changing our society and bringing about equality for everyone. Martin Luther King Jr. Day arrives Monday amid an increasingly divided nation and days ahead of the inauguration of Joe Biden and his vice president, Kamala Harris. Harris will make history as the first female to hold the vice presidency. King's message works in today's divisiveness because it is timeless, and Bucknell's Simone Forshey, acting director of the Griot Institute for the Study of Black Lives and Cultures, and an associate professor of history and international relations. He had a very real concern about racial injustice, but he also had a very strong message about social class, and that is absolutely relevant for today, she said. His message, she said, is timeless in that he was fighting for justice for all groups, not just for black Americans. I also think there is something to be said today for nonviolent protests. In that way, the Black Lives Matter protests were not out to diminish one group at the expense of another, for she said. The BLM movement has been saying, we want equality. Equality under the law. We want the same things that you have. A lot of that derives from what King was doing. If you question people about King's assassination, Edwards said, and what he was doing in Memphis, few would know that he was supporting sanitation engineers who were striking. People probably think he was there for some equal rights march for black people. That is where I think some of his message is lost today. Forshey believes students today don't learn as much about the history of the civil rights movement and nonviolent protests, so that when they are threatened while protesting in the street, there is an instinct to be defensive. That can escalate into violence, she said. A strong component of education is necessary to prepare people to be nonviolent, she said. And moving to the local and state page. Unemployment benefits could bring tax season surprise. Lose a job in 2020? Get ready, you could be hit with a tax bill in 2021. Millions of people lost jobs and claimed unemployment compensation across the country last year at restaurants, retailers, theaters, and other businesses faced massive cutbacks hit during the coronavirus-induced recession. And jobless benefits proved to be fairly generous, as the CARES Act offered an extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits beginning in April through July. As a result, some people nationwide may have received $1,000 or so a week in jobless benefits for 4 months. And yes, that $600 a week plus regular state unemployment benefits will be considered taxable income when you file your 2020 federal income tax return. Unemployment benefits currently are fully included in taxable income, said Mark Luscombe, principal analyst for Wolters Kluwer Tax and Accounting. But unlike wages, he said, unemployment benefits are not subject to payroll taxes, such as Social Security and Medicare taxes. More than 1 in 5 workers nationwide were out of work and seeking jobless benefits in the summer. Roughly 33.1 million workers were either on unemployment benefits, had been approved and were waiting for benefits, or had applied and were waiting to get approved as of June 30th, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. The tax season shocker for many jobless people will be that their tax refund could be far smaller than expected, or they might even owe taxes. Taxpayers may not be aware that unemployment is taxed, said Lisa Green Lewis, a certified public accountant and tax expert for TurboTax. How it all plays out will vary. It's possible, for example, that some families who have been hard hit financially will be eligible on their 2020 income tax return for income-based tax benefits that they couldn't qualify for in 2019. Green Lewis noted the generous tax benefits, such as the Child and Dependent Care Credit, might be available after incomes have fallen and offset some of the potential tax hit regarding jobless benefits. Those who worked part of the year might be eligible for other tax benefits, too. If someone was unemployed but also earned income as an employee or self-employed, Green Lewis said, they might now be eligible for the earned income tax credit worth up to $6,660 for a family of three kids when they might not have been eligible before. Unlike during the recession a decade ago, taxpayers aren't getting a federal income tax break on their jobless benefits. Years ago, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 offered a bit of a tax break to jobless people for unemployment compensation paid in 2009 only. On 2009 federal returns, taxpayers were able to exclude up to $2,400 of unemployment compensation from federal taxable income. Now you're not as fortunate on the federal 1040. While jobless benefits are taxable at the federal level, tax policies vary when it comes to state income taxes. Luscombe noted that it's important to remember that many states also tax unemployment benefits. Residents in six states, Alabama, California, Montana, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, will not pay income taxes on jobless benefits even though those states have a state income tax. States that don't have an income tax, such as Florida, aren't taxing jobless benefits at the state level. Where's your 1099-G? When it comes to doing your income taxes, the first step involves keeping an eye out for Form 1099-G, certain government payments, to show how much unemployment compensation you paid was paid to you in 2020. Taxpayers can receive a 1099-G faster if they request an electronic version. The 1099-G form would be available to view online or download by mid-January. Once you have the form 1099-G, you need to see Box 1. You're going to need to claim payments of $10 or more in unemployment compensation, including Railroad Retirement Board payments for unemployment. That is taxable, and it goes on Schedule 1 of Form 1040. Line 7, Buscombe said. Schedule 1 lists additional income, and Line 7 is clearly marked unemployment compensation. Did you already pay any taxes? For some people, the good news is that they might have already withheld some taxes out of their unemployment benefits in 2020. If so, the pain might be far less when you file your income taxes this year. It's important that you look at Box 4 on the Form 1099-G. Here is where you'd find federal income taxes that you had withheld out of those jobless benefits. Some people, though, could be caught by another trap for failing to pay Uncle Sam enough money up front during 2020. Luscombe said it is possible that some people who received jobless benefits but did not withhold taxes could be hit with an estimated tax penalty on top of the regular income tax that they're going to owe. Some may have paid taxes in quarterly installments, which have due dates for the estimated tax payments on April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th of the following year, or the following business day if the due date falls on a weekend or holiday. Some who received jobless benefits last year and didn't pay some taxes already may want to make an estimated payment, if necessary, by January 15th this year. That's true, especially if they're concerned that they'd owe more than $1,000 on their in federal income taxes on their 2020 return and could be hit by a penalty, Luscombe said. Withholding is voluntary. Federal law allows those receiving jobless benefits to choose to have a flat 10% withheld from their benefits to cover part or all of their tax liability. No other percentage or amount is allowed to be withheld to cover federal income taxes on jobless benefits. To do that, you need to fill out a W-4V form. And next, Macon man facing kidnapping charges. A police chief praised an interagency effort by law enforcement that led to a knife-wielding kidnapper who fled from the scene of his crime in Macon being arrested 48 hours later in Indiana. Blue Mound Police Chief Chad Lamb described the 32-year-old Macon suspect who was accused of abducting a 41-year-old woman and pursuing her at knife point as she managed to escape as very dangerous. And he's already registered with us as a convicted sexual predator, added Lamb. The man was found and arrested at a highway rest stop in Plainfield, Indiana, at 4:45 p.m. Friday by Indiana State Troopers. The drama began around 11:30 a.m. Wednesday at the P&V Quick Stop gas station just off U.S. 51 in Macon, in what Lamb described as very unusual circumstances. He explained that the suspect worked at the gas station and the victim was a customer who had walked in to get a soda on her lunch break. So he kidnapped this female at knife point and tied her up in the women's bathroom by gray taping her hands and mouth, said Lamb. He then left her to go steal money out of the store safe, and while he was doing that, she was able to bust loose out of the tape and run out of the front door towards her car. But Lamb said the suspect took off after her and tried to kidnap her again. There was basically an incident outside in the parking lot where he tried to abduct her there as well, and he swung and jabbed the knife at her, but she was able to fight him off, the chief added. She then sped away in her car. The terrified but physically unharmed woman fled to Moquegua and alerted the Moquegua Police Department, which in turn alerted Blue Mound, which provides law enforcement coverage to Macon. Lamb said officers were on the scene within 10 minutes of the incident happening and quickly ascertained the man had fled in a stolen car. We worked with the Macon County Sheriff's Office and the Macon County State's Attorney's Office and the U.S. Marshals to go after him, said Lamb. We were able, through the State's Attorney's Office, to get a warrant for $1 million bail. We were really hoping to find him. He was a very dangerous person to have out there in public. Just very dangerous. Lamb, speaking Sunday, said investigations into the circumstances of the kidnapping and whether it was premeditated or not were still continuing. He said the suspect is due to be extradited back from Indiana, where he is being held in custody early in the week. Lamb said the brazen nature of the crime, the fact the perpetrator was an employee, and the timing of it were all particularly strange. And we will take a short break now from the first half hour of our reading and resume after a short break. This is Wendy Bauer, and it's January 18th, 2021. I look forward to reading with you during our next half hour. Thank you.